My pleasure to be able to come here today and talk about the work that we've been doing at Emory University in Atlanta. Let me just get a show of hands. How many of you have ever been in a monogamous romantic relationship? How many have been in a not-so-monogamous relationship? Okay. How many of you know someone who has fallen head over heels for somebody and done something that just seems absolutely insane? All you've got to do is read the newspapers and see our politicians, the kinds of things that they do. So I'm really interested in understanding how, you know, the brain creates relationships and how the chemicals in the brain act to sort of drive our behaviors, and then also what might go wrong when we have difficulty in forming relationships. So I think everybody here appreciates how important social relationships are in our lives. They're important for our mental health. And we know that if we lose a relationship or don't have good, healthy relationships, we can suffer from mental disorders, depression, also physical diseases, cardiovascular disease. In fact, if a man loses his partner and doesn't have his partner anymore, there's an increased risk of mortality. So having a relationship helps us be healthy. And so I'm interested in understanding what's going on in here to make us have those relationships. And I'm just showing here an example of a kind of family, the nuclear family that we have in humans. And some of these relationships that we see in humans are evolutionarily very ancient. You see these across all mammals, for example. And that's, for example, the relationship between the mother and the baby. The maternal bond is one of the strongest drives there is in humans, or in all mammals. But humans also have different kinds of relationships, like the relationship between the male and the female. We form a bond that lasts for a while. And in most species, this is actually very rare, in 97% of all mammalian species, the male and female, after they mate, they have no relationship whatsoever. They go their separate ways. The female raises her babies by herself, and the male is out to try to find another mate. But in 3% of species, something happens when they come together, they form a relationship, and they stick together. So I'm interested in how does that evolve? Because in 97% a species, they don't, but occasionally they do. So how do you begin to understand the chemistry that's going on in the brain in the formation of these relationships? Well, if you want to understand sort of brain mechanisms of behavior in humans, you can learn a little bit by putting people in brain scanners and looking at brain activity, maybe showing them pictures of their loved ones or whatever. But if you really want to get down to the chemistry, you've got to have an animal model. And this is the animal model that I study. These are called prairie voles. These are right here in Illinois area. These guys are great models for understanding human social behavior because, like humans, these guys form a family that stays together for nearly a lifetime. Male, female are out in the prairie. If a male goes and he tries to court the female, and if she likes him, they'll mate. And a transformation occurs in the brain when they mate such that now both the male and the female really want to be with each other. They nest together, raise their offspring together, and the male spends just as much time licking and grooming and caring for those pups as does the female. And if one of them loses their partner, most often the other one never takes on another partner. Now, that's not all prairie voles are not the same. So some are more promiscuous and some are more monogamous. There's a lot of individual variation. So again, I think it's a pretty good model for humans. And also, I want to say that these guys are socially monogamous. That means they're not sexually monogamous, which means that if a male is wandering, a pair-bonded male is wandering through the prairie and a female in estrus comes by, he may actually mate with that female. But the important thing is that he comes back to his partner at night. So what we're studying here is the bond, the emotional connection between the two, not sexual monogamy. So I just wanted to get that straight. Now, why does monogamy evolve in the first place? 97% of species don't do it. Well, there's a couple of reasons why we think it evolves. And one is maybe it takes two to raise a family, right? If there are predators in the environment and you need both parents around to fight off those predators, if a male decides to be completely promiscuous and he just goes off and mates with many females, he may have 100 babies. But none of those babies will survive. So the genes that caused him to do that will not be passed on to the next generation. But the guy who says he finds a female, he says, wow, I really like this female. I want to stick with her. I want to help her raise the offspring. He may only have 6 babies, but those 6 babies will survive and pass those genes that make him think like that into the next generation. Also, some situations, it's just hard to find a good partner. Hopefully, this doesn't apply to any of you guys, but But sometimes it is hard to find a good partner, and if you find a good partner, you should stick with that partner, right? A good example of that is this deep sea anglerfish. These guys live in the deep, dark, vast ocean. They have little bioluminescent antenna here. You can imagine that a male can spend half of his lifetime just trying to find a female. So when he finds a female, he should bond with that female. And this is exactly what they do. He bonds with her by biting her, never letting go. His blood vessels fuse with hers. They basically disintegrates until there's nothing much left but his most important body parts, and that's his hypothalamus and his gonads, testes. And now you might think this guy has lost a lot of independence and quality of life. But what he's gained is the ability that every time she is ready to spawn, he's there to fertilize those eggs. So he's going to have thousands and thousands of babies carrying the genes that caused him to do that. The guy who said, I'm not going to do that, I'm going to be, you know, independent, he's never going to have any babies. So genes get knocked out. So that's how natural selection creates different behaviors, whatever is the most adaptive. Oops, yeah, is that love? There's different ways of creating monogamy. They don't always have to be love. So how do we study love in these, or bonding in these prairie voles? We have this test, it's called a partner preference test. We put a male and a female together, and we can allow them to mate, or we can prevent them from mating, or we can give them drugs, or do all kinds of things. And then we separate them, and we give them a choice between their partner. Here we're taking the male partner, put him on this side. He has a little collar around his neck. He can move around this cage, but he can't get out. We take another male, put him over here, and then we drop the female in the middle, and we just see who she spends her time with for the next 3 hours. If she's pair bonded, she will spend most of the time with her partner. If she's not, she'll go back and forth and not have a preference. If the animals mate, we know that mating is what triggers that transformation in the brain so that they form that bond. And I have a little video here. Here is a male in the middle. We can put the male in the middle too. Female partner's on this side. He spent the night with her last night. He's never seen that female over there. Most males of other species would choose the new female, but here he's having a choice. He's going to go out and check out this new female. And I want you to see how he behaves towards her. When they form a bond, not only do they prefer to be with their partner, but they show a little bit of aggression towards other females, other potential mates. And now look how he's going to go over and check out his partner. And you can see how differently he behaves towards his partner. So we can quantify that behavior in the laboratory and see what kind of chemicals lead to that behavior. Now, I want to start talking about a molecule that we know is really important in the bonding process. It's a molecule called oxytocin. Oxytocin is the molecule, if anybody's ever been induced into labor, that's the molecule that the doctor gave you. It is a molecule that causes uterus contractions and the progression of labor. Once the baby is born and the baby is nursing, oxytocin is released from the brain that goes down to the breast to cause milk to be ejected in the baby's mouth. So it's really critical for giving birth and providing nutrients to the offspring. But we also know that is the molecule that is released in the brain when she is nursing that causes a transformation in her brain so that she thinks that baby is the most important thing in the world. You take a virgin rat. Females never had birth. You put a pup, baby rats, in a cage. What do you think they do? Okay, they don't like them. They try to bury them. They might eat them, but they just don't like them. But when that female gets pregnant, she goes through that pregnancy and experiences all those hormones, and just before she gives birth, suddenly she thinks, wow, pups are the most attractive thing in the world. When she gives birth to her own pups, if you put those pups across an electrified grid, she'll cross that electrified grid to get access to those pups. And we can cause that same kind of behavior in a virgin if we just inject into her brain a little bit of that oxytocin. Okay, it induces the bond, the maternal nurturing, and also the bond to the baby. So because of that, we thought maybe in prairie voles, where the female is bonding to not only her babies, but to the male, maybe this is involved in that bonding process as well. So we did a very simple experiment where we take females who've never mated, and we have to inject the drugs directly into the brain because there's a blood-brain barrier that protects our brain from most chemicals. So we inject it directly into the brain, oxytocin, and then placed her in the cage with a male for a short amount of time, 6 hours. They did not mate. And what we found is that single chemical that we injected in the brain can induce the formation of a bond between that female and the male. Single chemical is inducing the formation of a social bond here. When I say single chemical, I don't mean it's the only chemical that's doing it, but it is a chemical that you can induce with. Now, one of the cool things about the voles is that there are different species of voles. that look very similar, that have very different behavior. So the prairie voles I mentioned, they're socially monogamous. They're also very highly social. They just love to interact with each other socially. But we also have meadow voles, which I have a couple in my pocket here. No, I don't. Well, they're out somewhere. These guys look the same, but these guys are asocial. They don't care about interacting with others. They prefer to be by themselves. They're totally promiscuous. So they're very different. So I thought it would be a good way to like look and see what is in the brain is different between animals that can form bonds and ones that cannot. Now, since oxytocin is involved in that process of bonding, you might think prairie voles have a lot more oxytocin. But if you look into the brain, you'll see there's exactly the same amount of oxytocin. But if you think a little bit about how chemicals in the brain act, how neurons communicate with each other, you have two components. One is the neurotransmitter or neuromodulator itself, like oxytocin, that's released from one neuron. And it doesn't do anything in the world unless it binds to a protein called a receptor on another neuron. And if that neuron has a receptor, it activates that neuron or does something to that neuron. If a neuron doesn't have those receptors, a neurotransmitter has no effect. So we thought, well, let's look at the receptors of the oxytocin. And if you look in the brain, we can slice the brains of these animals, put on some radioactive oxytocin, put it on film, and get an image of where those receptors are, we can see something really remarkable. The prairie voles, the monogamous species, have high concentration of this sort of bonding molecule receptor in an area called the nucleus accumbens. The non-monogamous species have very few receptors there. The nucleus accumbens is special because this is where dopamine acts to give us reward and reinforcement. It's where cocaine acts to create addictions. And this is an area of the brain that has this receptor that's involved in bonding. And we know that these receptors are the ones that are critical for bonding because if we block these receptors and put her in a cage with a male and let her mate, she will not bond. If we block other receptors, she will. So by injecting these drugs into various regions, we can begin to identify the circuits that are involved in processes like bonding. So these receptors are important. Now, males are a little bit different. Oxytocin may play some role, but another molecule seems to be playing a more important role, and that's a molecule called vasopressin. Vasopressin is interesting because it's sexually dimorphic. It's one of the most sexually dimorphic molecules in the brain. Sexually dimorphic means males have a different level than females. So this is a little part of the brain called lateral septum. The white spots here are the vasopressin staining. The male has much more than the females. This is a testosterone-driven molecule. And it drives behaviors that are typical of males of a given species. So for example, some species are very highly territorial. Hamsters, for example, are territorial. If you inject a little bit of vasopressin into the brain of a hamster and put it down, it'll start scent marking everything around, making its territory. It also becomes very aggressive, sort of like that male that I showed you with the female. In prairie voles, it also induces the formation of a bond. So it's doing something very different in a prairie vole than it is in other species. It is also inducing a territorial and aggressive behavior, but it's creating this bond. And I think if you think about evolutionarily what this means, that these two behaviors that are kind of similar, the bonding of the female to the male and the bonding of the male to the female, evolved through modulation of circuits that already existed, that the female bond to the male evolved from tweaking of the neural mechanisms that are involved in maternal nurturing. So it's a very maternal, nurturing kind of bond. But the male bonding to the female evolved from adaptations of systems that are involved in territorial behavior. So maybe for the prairie vole, the female is kind of an extension of his territory, and he defends that territory vigorously. So again, for the males, we were asking, what is different in a male that forms a bond that versus one that cannot? And if you slice the brain again and look at where those receptors are, which brain circuits can respond to vasopressin that's released when he's with his partner, you see, again, prairie voles have high densities of receptors some places, and the non-monogamous species don't. So when this guy mates with a female, he's activating a different set of circuitry than these guys are. This is the major output of the nucleus accumbens called the ventral pallidum. This is where cocaine also acts to create addiction. So in both males and females, circuitry that are involved in addiction are involved in the formation of a bond. It's kind of neat. And so we know that these are the ones that are important because if you do an experiment or you drop in vasopressin receptor blockers into various areas, only if you block this receptors do the animals not bond. Maybe these are doing something else. So we know vasopressin and oxytocin are not the only things that are involved. We have also dopamine, which is the molecule that gives us the feel-good pleasure. There's also opiates. This is what heroin acts on. So things that gives us real pleasure. So it's a real chemical cocktail that's going together to create a bond. And I want to explain to you what I think is happening to create this bond. Okay, imagine this is an animal. He's with a female, and maybe they're mating. And that experience, or they're interacting in some way, that experience activates this area of the brain that releases dopamine that creates this exhilarating feeling. Wow, that was good. I like that. And for a rat, maybe he doesn't... I should say oxytocin and vasopressin, what they do is they focus the attention on the cues of the other individual. Like for a mother, when she's releasing that oxytocin, she's focusing her attention on the baby, looking at the eyes, looking at every little emotion. And that's what oxytocin is doing in vasopressin. But when a rat is with a partner and they're releasing this dopamine and feeling pleasure, they are thinking, who was I with? And they are thinking this was with a female, for example, if it was a male. And so he will spend the rest of his life trying to find a female to activate that brain circuitry again. But for prairie voles, because they have these high densities of receptors that are involved in perception of social cues in the nucleus accumbens or the ventral pallidum, they are saying, wow, that was great. Who was I with? I was with a particular individual. And they make an association between that reward and the particular individual that they're with, and then they prefer to spend time with that individual. Okay, so it's really a linking of the identity of the other individual with the reward of the social interaction. So here's a cool experiment that we did to test this out. This is the prairie vole, the monogamous male brain. This is a non-monogamous male brain. You see, he has more receptors there than here. We can actually take the gene from the monogamous species, put it into a virus, then take that virus and inject it into the brain of the non-monogamous species to change the level of expression of that receptor. So we create metal voles now whose ventral pallidum, this area that's involved in addiction, can respond to the vasopressin that's released in the male. So we have control animals where we injected a different virus that did nothing, and then we have these guys, and we found now that when these guys, when we transform their brain with this single gene in the single brain area, these guys would now form a pair bond and bond with their partner. So it's, I think this is really good evidence that you can change around a single gene, and it can have a profound impact on even very complex behavior, because you're changing the way circuits that are involved in more general processes are responding to particular situations. So I'm also interested in how does experience affect our lives. We all have different kind of social experiences growing up. Some have not so good, others have really good. So how does that impact the ability to form relationships later in life? This is an experiment where my graduate student did, where she took prairie vole pups, and for 3 hours a day, she would take them and put them in this little warm chamber, no change in temperature, but the pups were just isolated, so they had no social contact for those 3 hours a day. After the 3 hours, they go back with the mom and dad. And she did that for the first 2 weeks of life. And then after that, she treated them all exactly the same. She would let them grow up to be adults. So several months later, she then tested them to see if they were able to form this partner preference, the pair bond. And the control animals that were not separated, they spend much more time with the partner than the stranger after 24 hours of being with a male. The ones that had this early life social stressor, social isolation, much less as a group. But she noticed that there were some in there that could and some in there that couldn't, and she looked in the brain, and we stained for the oxytocin receptors, and we found that there's a lot of individual variation in how many receptors they are, how dark it was, how sensitive that brain area was. And she found that those animals that had the low densities of receptors for whatever reason, they were totally unable to form a bond with a partner. So they were susceptible to early life stressors. Those other ones that had the high densities of receptors were totally resilient, nothing impacted. And now we've identified a gene that controls this. So now we have a single gene, polymorphism, that determines how much of receptors in the brain that are responding to this bonding molecule that can affect the way people relate to others, or voles relate to others. And so we think that the animals that have the high densities of receptors, when they are reunited with their parents, they're getting oxytocin stimulation, because their parents are licking and grooming them, and oxytocin is being released and activating these guys much more signaling than these guys. These just guys just can't respond to the same level of licking and grooming. So it suggests that early contact with the parents is important for regulating and shaping the social brain. This is a study that I find just fascinating. This is a study where they took fathers, human fathers now, with 3-month-old children, and they gave them a sniff of oxytocin. Because if you sniff oxytocin, kind of like cocaine, it can get into the brain. And then they found, they didn't give it to the kid, so they gave it to the father, and then they told the father to interact with the kid. Some of the fathers got placebo. They didn't know what they got. They just got placebo. Some of them got oxytocin. They found that the fathers that got the oxytocin spent more time physically touching the child, engaging with the child, sort of doing reciprocal behaviors with the child, and calling the child if it looked away. They measured in the blood. Of course, the fathers that got the sniff of oxytocin had more oxytocin in their saliva than the ones who got the placebo. But the remarkable thing is that the baby of the father who got the injection of oxytocin also experienced this surge in oxytocin. So this suggests that the interactions of parents with offspring can have a big impact on the these molecules that are involved in relationships. And I think that this is critical for building connections that help us be able to relate to others. We actually did a study at Emory. We looked at women who experienced early life abuse and neglect when they were children, when they were girls. And we found that those women, they're adults now, who experienced early life abuse and neglect, if you sample the oxytocin in their cerebral spinal fluid, they have lower oxytocin. So I think that this sort of your social experiences can really shape these molecules. We also look at what happens when you lose a partner. You know, we all know someone who's lost a loved one and how devastating that can be, right? So we did the experiment in these voles because we know that most voles, if they lose a partner in nature, they don't take on another partner. Why not? So we did this kind of cool experiment where we took male prairie voles and we either let them hang out with their brother, or we put them with a female so that they would go through this transformation of forming a bond. And then we took some of the males and we separated them from their brother. Oh, sorry, you left them paired with the brother, or we isolated them. We took the brother away so they were by themselves. And then we took some of the ones that were paired with the female and left them paired and then separated them. And then we did a couple of tests where we put the animal in a difficult situation. So, for example, we put them in a pool of water. And it's known that if animals are depressed, they will just float. They just give up. Okay? Or you can hang them up by the tail for a short amount of time, and if they're depressed, they just hang there. If they're not depressed, they right themselves. So we did these two tests, and I want you to look at this. This is how long they float, just give up, when they're floating in the water, and they're in the water. If they were bonded with a female, and still with the female, they floated very little. If their female was taken away, they just floated. They didn't struggle to get out of a difficult situation. If they were with their brother, or their brother was taken away so they were by themselves, no big deal. They were struggled. So here it suggests that losing a partner, losing a pair-bonded partner, really can have a devastating impact on sort of emotionality in these guys. We saw that there was increases in a molecule called CRF in the brain. That is involved in regulation of the stress axis. And if we block this receptor, immediately when the female was taken out away from him by a drug, he was perfectly fine. He didn't get depressed. So we could prevent this grieving by blocking this receptor. And I think that this is really an adaptive mechanism that's evolved, really to, you might think it's sort of maladaptive. Why would they get depressed? Well, what happens is that when they're away from their partner, they get this negative affect. They feel the stress levels rise. They feel not so good. Almost like a drug addict, is when he's without his drug, starts feeling uneasy. And he'll do anything to get back that feeling of when that drug is around. And so this is a mechanism, I think, of maintaining relationships. The first part was dopamine, the pleasure, the excitement, sort of like the beginning of drug use. But then after a long time, the relationship is, that excitement is not always there. And sometimes it's more the hurt of being away that keeps the relationship together. Okay, so now, some of you might be thinking, oh, you're doing all this stuff in voles. What does this have to do with humans? And so I'll show you some examples of how the work that we found in voles first has now been shown to be true in humans. There's been two genetic studies done. We're looking at people, thousands of people that were in a live-in relationship for a long time. They do gene polymorphisms, and they find people that have different sequences of genes. In this study, this is a Swedish group, found that males that have a certain version of the vasopressin receptor have more difficulties in their relationships, and their wives are more dissatisfied with their relationship. For females, the same is true for oxytocin. So genetic polymorphisms in these receptors has some predictive value. It doesn't dictate behavior, but it's on a statistical level, it seems to affect the quality of relationships, just like in voles. People began to ask, what does oxytocin do in people? And by giving them the intranasal oxytocin, and one of the first studies that came out showed that it increased trust. People were given money, and they took intranasal oxytocin. They trusted more people with the money more than they would if they had not taken the oxytocin. And so now you can buy this product on the web. We'll see if... Okay, here it goes. So this is the website that you can go to.
Imagine for a moment that everyone trusted you. You would sell more, love more, and accomplish more than you ever imagined. Scientists have discovered a hormone that increases people's trust in each other. It is the human hormone, oxytocin. And for the first time, with liquid trust,
okay, I'm trying to figure out how to turn this
you
off.
Can harness this power to increase other people's trust.
Okay, turn it off.
In you.
Okay. All right, so you can go to that website. So they tell you to take this product and spray it on you before you go out on an important business deal, and then that person might trust you and you might land that deal. Does that make sense to you guys? What happens if you spray this stuff on you? Who's going to trust who? Right? So you have to be sort of thinking about these things critically before you go out and waste your money on these things. You're going to go out and, make some bad business deals. Now they have this thing called Liquid Trust Enhanced that's been specifically designed to give a boost to the dating and relationship scene of your life. This has same great oxytocin, but now includes powerful pheromones. So you can put something on you, the pheromones are attracting the opposite sex, and the oxytocin is making them trust you. But again, this is not really going to work. Remember, I told you there's a blood-brain barrier, so you have to really sniff a lot of this stuff to get any of it into the brain. So it's just ridiculous. But there have been a lot of studies that have used the amounts that can get in the brain. I'm just going to show you a couple of examples more. Here's a study that was done in Germany just last year where they wanted to look at how it affected people's personal distance, how far away they liked people to be from each other. And they took male subjects, men, who were either in a monogamous relationship or were single. And then they had what they called an attractive German experimenter. Standing at some distance away, and then the attracted German experimenter just walked up closer to the male, and the male was instructed to tell me when it starts to get uncomfortable. Okay, and they thought, well, oxytocin, of course, is going to make everybody want to be closer to the female. What they found is that for the single guys, it didn't matter. They didn't want them closer. They didn't want them further away. But for the monogamous guys, they actually asked the female to stop at a further distance away, suggesting that maybe oxytocin is helping maintain the monogamous relationship by keeping the attractive German experimenters away. And they suggested that if women want to keep their males faithful to them, they need to do things that would stimulate oxytocin release. A number of other studies have shown things like intranasal oxytocin increases the amount of time looking into the eyes of others. We spend more time looking into the eyes. That's where we get a lot of our information. I'm looking at you guys, and I'm looking at you in the eyes. I'm not looking at your ears, except for the one guy back there. I keep looking. It also increases the ability to read the emotions of others, right? We can look at the facial expression and understand what the other person is thinking better if we're having oxytocin. So this got me to thinking, as well as others, that maybe this molecule that helps us, that is making social information more salient, more important to us, that's drawing our attention to that, that's helping us read that social information, maybe that would be useful in disorders where the people have a fundamental deficit in the ability to relate to others, that tend not to be able to read the emotions of others, that don't get reward and reinforcement from relating to others. And that's autism. It's just one example. There's several other examples. And there's been several studies now that have shown that if you take children with autism, or adults, these are all adults, there's children studies going on now, but in the adults, if they've taken intranasal oxytocin, it does have result in some improvement of, say, attention to the eyes, for example, the ability to read the emotions of others. But it's relatively modest. But it's very promising. But I don't think that intranasal oxytocin by itself is going to be a real treatment. It's a very short-lived thing. But I also think that the effect that they are seeing here is minimal because the amount of oxytocin that gets into the brain with the intranasal is nothing like the experience that what a mother experiences when she's nursing her baby. When she's nursing her baby, she's getting boluses, releases of oxytocin from oxytocin neurons that are having a powerful effect. So at Emory, we have started a drug discovery program, a drug discovery for autism, where we are trying to think of ways to stimulate the brain's oxytocin release just like a baby stimulates a mother's oxytocin release. And we can do that by knowing something about oxytocin neurons, finding some receptors that are on those neurons, where there are drugs that you can use to target those receptors, to induce those receptors to release oxytocin directly into the brain. So this is our strategy for future drug development. And it turns out that there is a molecule. I won't tell you too much about what it is. There's a receptor that if you hit that receptor with a drug, it causes oxytocin release. And we've done this sort of pilot study where this is a real study, in voles where we just inject this drug peripherally. We don't have to inject it directly into the brain. And then we see how it affects their pair bonding, and you can see that the animals get the drug, they have very much, very strong preference for the partner than the stranger. So it is inducing oxytocin-like behavior. And so what we think that the way that this type of drug, this type of therapy might be useful is not just to give a kid or an adult with autism a drug that makes them have high levels of oxytocin all the time, but rather to do it strategically right before the therapy sessions that are very useful now that seem to be working. The best treatment for the behavioral deficits in autism now is behavioral therapies where you immerse the child in a therapy session with a therapist. You force the eye contact and you teach them how to read emotions and things like that. But imagine if you can take this child before he goes in there, activate this oxytocin system so that his brain is open and attentive to that therapist, spending more time looking at the therapist, and perhaps it'll have a much more beneficial effect. And so this is what we're working on at Emory. And so here's the sort of the way I think about it, that prairie voles, this bonding, which is kind of related to love and, you know, relationships, things that we all think about, it's kind of all interesting, that this can actually be a model for social learning, the ability to learn social information, and drugs that you give to a vole that could induce a partner preference may also be useful in treating disorders of social deficits. So it's sort of an animal model of screening, high throughput screening of drugs that might be useful in treating autism. So that's it. If you're interested in this kind of stuff about how the chemicals in the brain affect things like maternal bonding, sexuality, cheating, infidelity, all these kinds of things, what is texting as opposed to talking to each other face-to-face affecting our society, there's a book that I wrote that sort of pulls all this stuff together from both animal work also into humans.